Welcome to Murder Most Foul, a podcast devoted to exploring famous murder cases of our time. Some solved, some unsolved, but all fascinating and guaranteed to raise the hairs on the back of your neck. I'm your host, Jim Solanowski. Today's episode, Killing Spree. I saw her standing on her front lawn, just a twirling her baton. Me and her went for a ride, sir, and 10 innocent people died. From the town of Lincoln, Nebraska, with a sawed-off 410 on my lap, through to the Badlands of Wyoming, I kill everything in my path. I can't say that I'm sorry for the things that we done, at least for a little while, sir. Me and her, we had us some fun. Now the jury brought in a guilty verdict, and the judge, he sentenced me to death. Midnight in prison storeroom, with leather straps across my chest. Sheriff, when the man pulls that switch, sir, and snaps my poor head back, you make sure my pretty baby is sitting right there on my lap. They declared me unfit to live, said into the great void my soul be hurled. They want to know why I did what I did. Sir, I guess there's just a meanness in this world. Those are the lyrics of the song Nebraska, written by Bruce Springsteen in 1982, immortalizing the killing spree of Charles Starkweather and Carol Ann Fugate in Lincoln, Nebraska, in nearby Wyoming, in 1957 and 58. Were Charlie and Carol Ann a new breed of Bonnie and Clyde? Was 14-year-old Carol Ann a willing and equal participant in 10 ruthless and gruesome murders, or was she a hostage? Books, movies, and endless documentaries have tried to answer that question. Harry N. McLean has an inside track on the story, having grown up at the time in Lincoln, Nebraska, contemporaneously with Starkweather and Fugate. Today, on Murder Most Foul, Mr. McLean shares his recollection of the period and what it was like to return to Lincoln to research his book, Starkweather, The Untold Story of the Killing Spree That Changed America. Welcome, Harry.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
So today we're talking about a case that is not unknown to the world. Many movies, documentaries, 2020, Dateline, this and that, books about Charles Starkweather and Carol Ann Fugate. Harry, you, of course, what I usually end up picking up a book on the case. And the one we were talking about is your book, of course, called Starkweather, with a subtitle, The Untold Story of the Killing Spree That Changed America. So before we get into the book and research and how you went about doing this, it's a very simple question that I have for you. Why did you decide to pick up this subject matter and devote a lot of time to it to write this very in-depth book?
I had come up to it a couple times and taken a look at it and then walked away from it. Most of the crimes took place in Nebraska, and several of them were in Lincoln. I'm from Lincoln. So I was 14 years old living in Lincoln when these crime spree took place. And over the years, I've kind of walked up to it and thought about it because I'm a true crime writer and this happened in my hometown. But I ended up being very wary of it because I knew it was going to involve a difficult time for me. That was a difficult time in my life. I knew some of the victims that were killed. I was going to have to relive that process and those friends. And so I kind of stayed away from it. And then in February 2020, I was working on a novel, and I had kind of a Sark Weather theme in. And I said, well, I'll go on Current Affair or something like that and take a look at Carol Ann and see what it is, see what it is she's saying. Well, it's an incredibly convincing presentation. She's either innocent or a great actress, or she might actually believe she's innocent. A lot of time has passed. She's had a lot of trauma in her life. But about that same time, she had requested a pardon in 2018. And right around this time, the pardon was denied. And that got a lot of press. I picked that up and I thought, nobody really knows for sure what her level of involvement in the killings were. She was convicted of a felony murder. She was convicted by the public at large in Nebraska and in most books that have been written about it and stories of being a killer herself. And that was the one open question. And that's what finally pulled me into it, because I'm a lawyer and a former judge. And I thought, okay, I can deal with all this other stuff because I can come at this piece of it like a judge, like a lawyer. What's the evidence? What are the facts to support her as being complicit in the murders? Not what are the inferences, not what are the suggestions, not one of the hypotheticals, but what actual facts do you have on the table to convict this woman? So coming at it like a lawyer kind of was my way into it without any kind of leaving the anxiety about going home again. So that was the beginning.
In cases of horrendous murders like this case, armchair psychiatrists, psychologists, of course, turn to the upbringing of the perpetrator, try to blame it on family, on abuse. What was Charlie's background?
He did. He was the second of eight children, and it was a poor family. The dad had some injuries. The mom worked hard, but there was no evidence that I came. I think he smacked him a couple times. That I did come across, but it wasn't so traumatic that he was injured by it. He remained close to his dad all the way through his life. Charlie's problem was, if I can put it that way, that was the way he appeared. He was short for a male. At that time, the average height was 5'8". He was a little under 5'5". He had bow legs and flaming red hair, thick flaming red hair. And he was pigeon-toed and had a lisp. And so all the way through grade school, he was taunted, ridiculed, made fun of, in class, out in the hallway, in the yard, in the schoolyards, at church. People mocked him and made fun of him. And he kind of took it. And then one day he came home and his dad looked at him. He'd been crying. And he told him what happened and said, well, I'm going to talk to the school. We talked to the school. They didn't do anything about it. So when it happened again, he said, look, next time it happens, smack him. And Charlie took it to heart, and that began his transformation into a bully himself. He was a little guy, like I said, but he fought with a vengeance because he had anger fueling it all. And he'd take on a guy. My brother was in school with him at Irving Junior High and knew who he was. And every school had a fighter or two, and sometimes the junior, they would meet and have something in the schoolyard. But Charlie's reputation was that he was a vicious fighter, and that, if you got down on the ground, he'd kick you, or he would rub your face into the gravel. So that reputation spread, and it made him stand a little taller. It didn't go away. It didn't do away with the rage that had been fueling it. And he ended up developing a fantasy then about being an outlaw and having a gang and dying in a shootout. And all he needed to make this fantasy come true was a girl. The outlaw needs a girl. That's about when he met Carol. He was 17 when he met her. Carol was had just turned 13 when Charlie ran into her, and they became a pair. That's kind of a different story, but those are the two main characters that lead us into the violence.
And again, part of this fantasy that he had was I don't know if he took it on or people attributed to him this James Dean. I mean, he always had a cigarette, hanging out of his mouth, and it was a real, a lot of the poses you see of him is right out of James Dean leaning on a car or something. And you put it well that this fantasy of outlaw and that. He and it got worse as time went on during the we're going to talk about the crimes that were committed by him that all the time he's looking for that big shootout or that big ending glory and whatever that would be. So let tell us a little bit about then 13 12 13 year old Carol Ann Fugate.
She came from a very poor family, a very violent family. Her dad was a drunk and seldom worked and beat up the mother and was a convicted pedophile himself. So she was raised in chaos. She went to six different schools in 5 years. So she never settled in and had friends anywhere, never connected with anybody, and her home was violent. Finally, they got divorced. The mother remarried a decent guy, and she had stability in her life, but she still was who she was. I mean, she still had to live with her childhood. And Charlie came into it and said, "You're the most important person in my life." She'd never been the most important person in anybody's life before, and I think Charlie exploited this with some degree of consciousness or awareness of what he was doing, and so they clung together. As a couple. And that's somewhat what gives the story some of its appeal, is that it's this young couple, kind of a Bonnie and Clyde sort of thing. And Charlie did look like James Dean. If you didn't look at his overall stature and his legs, he looked like James Dean, and he practiced hanging the cigarette out of his mouth just the way James Dean did. And he took pleasure in posing before the cops and the photographers to get as many pictures of him as he could, looking like James Dean.
Now, it's clear from your book, Harry, that the Fugate family was not very enamored of Charlie, were they?
No, that's definitely right. I mean, particularly her stepfather didn't want him around. She's, 13, 14 years old as this is going on, and here's a 17, 18, 19-year-old paying attention to her. What good is going to come from that, He finished high school, but barely. They kind of just moved him on out. So he had no real, he was a garbage man. He worked on his brother's garbage route. And the stepfather was very against the thing. The mother kind of went along with it for some reason I've never been able to uncover. But she would go 6, 7 hours, 8 hours hanging around with Charlie, going to his apartment, going to the drag races, going roller skating. And she had a relationship in her life that meant something to her.
The first murder that Charlie committed was on November 30th, 1957, and did not involve Carol Ann Fugate. It was at least it was characterized as a robbery of Robert Colvert, who was a gas station attendant, which ended up in murder.
Yeah, that's true. And I think I know they always characterized it as a robbery. In my theory of Charlie's, I mean, he did rob him, but I think he intended to kill him regardless of what happened. I don't think the robbery could have gone good. He was going to die. He was going to kill him. I actually think he wanted to find out what killing somebody was like, what it felt like. So he did this on his own, by his own words. He came out feeling pretty good about it. It was kind of a new Charlie. It was kind of a new start. He was a killer now, and that kind of laid the groundwork for what was to come.
Now, what is to come is a, and again, this is in the book, a wonderful vehicle, a conceit, if you will, in the book, that in each case, you then put forth the version by Charlie, and that comes from obviously interviews with the police and at the trial, and what we get a nice capsulization, a narrative of what he said went down. And then you, right after that, we have what Carol said, because she was there at all these murders, that what she said went down. Now, there's a connection where a lot of the facts might be the same, but through each of their eyes, and also their eyes are colored by self-interest, how they are presenting, well, I did this and she did that. And then she says, he did that and I did that. The actual, you know, the bottom line is these people were killed. Now, the murder of Robert Colvert is never solved, at least at this point. And Charlie's never suspected. And so, as you said, he's got a new bravado going and he's feeling good. And he turns to his next murder crime. And it turns out, I just don't know, it was the massacre of Carol Ann Fugate's family.
That was January 21st. It was a Tuesday. And she had supposedly broken up with him on the previous Sunday, and the mother told him not to come around anymore. He went over there supposedly to go hunting with her stepfather, which was a myth. I mean, they would never have done that. He went over there with a rifle and ended up killing the stepfather, the mother, shooting him with the 22, stepfather, the mother, and her little 2.5-year-old sister.
So at this point, the stories of the narration by Charlie and the narration by Carol kind of diverge. In Charlie's version, Carol not only is there, but she participates.
The big dispute is whether Carol was there at the time of those killings or not. If she was, the story goes off one way. If she wasn't, it goes off another way. That analysis has always been superficial or grossly inadequate. Someone just takes a fact and says, well, she had to be there. Fact was, she completed school. She came home from school. So you got that time nailed down. It had to be after she came home, which is about 4 o'clock. But it's a, I could go into it, but let me just say it's an in-depth analysis of whether she was there or not. There's a lot of different facts about what Charlie did, phone calls that he made and so forth. And that, and you know, frankly, I wasn't invested in finding her innocent. It would have been a good book either way. So I came at that issue stone cold, and it just doesn't add up that she was there when it happened. So that's the initial finding. Now, there's a lot of weird things about it. They stayed in that house. She came home at 4. He told her that he had her parents held hostage somewhere, and if she tried to run, he would have them killed. And she believed it. Now, it's hard to believe it that she believed it, but she's a 14-year-old girl, totally unsophisticated, never been out of Lincoln. Not, you know, education real spotty. Charlie was her hero. And I, you know, that's if I have any doubt about anything in her story, it's that. But so anyway, they stayed there for 6 days, people coming by looking for him. Finally, on the following Monday, her grandmother came by and couldn't get in the house. And she said, I'm going to go get the cops. And so Charlie and Carol fled in his car through Lincoln, getting it fixed and stopping for gas and so forth. And so now we're at three murders in this spree. They end up in Bennett, a little town about 20 miles south of Lincoln. And they go on the farm of a friend of his, really, August Meyer, where he had hunted over the years. Charlie ends up killing. By this time, he's got her father's shotgun. So he uses the shotgun and blows August Meyer's head off in front of Carol. So if she wasn't there for the murders of her family, this is the first time she knows Charlie is a killer. Thank you. and it happened right in front of her, and the, you know, the whole scene was a few feet away from her, including the damage to August Meyer's head. It's nighttime. It's cold there. I've been out to that farm. It's really out in the middle of nowhere. I mean, you've got to take this little lane out to August Meyer's house, and it's 4 or 5 miles off the road and very, very out of the way. So they end up getting stuck in the car. Getting the car stuck in the mud and having to abandon it. And they're hitchhiking then, and another couple stops to pick them up. He's 17, Bobby Jensen 17, and Carol Keene is 16. They're driving their sweethearts. They're two out of the five members of the junior class of the Bennett High School. And you know, if you know the Midwest in those days, somebody's hitchhiking, you stop. You know, it's just as simple as that. And they're even carrying weapons, and they stopped for them. They could see the weapons. So that goes on. They get in the car. They drive around, and it ends up Charlie kills both of them and dumps them in a storm cellar. He would later claim that Carol killed the girl. Carol Fugate killed Carol King. But there's no evidence for that other than Charlie saying it. So now you're two more bodies down. The cops are trying to find him now. They know who it is. They can't find him. They're making one mistake after another. They keep thinking they're gone and they're not gone. They keep thinking, okay, they're here. Then they are gone. They revisit crime scenes awkwardly for no real reason. And a general panic is starting to set in Nebraska now because these bodies keep turning up. There's three of them, and then there's August Meyer, and then there's this couple. And no one has ever seen Charlie. No one, he's like a ghost. No one ever sees him or his car or Carol.
Now, we love to categorize or label things. This was technically not serial killing, as we look at the traditional serial killers, if you will. Where do you put it in the sort of realm of murder?
You know, my theory is that this was a new type of murder. It was the first mass murder of the modern age. There had been some back right after the war. And of course you have Bonnie and Clyde, but they were robbers. Charlie was something new. He murdered random people without a motive. I mean, robbery was not with them. And he did it because he was living out his fantasy, clearly a sociopath. But this is new behavior for a sociopath. You know, the sociopath might kill his mother, might sit in the basement and stick pins in her doll, you know, something like that. Wild, sick behavior, but it had never been acted out on strangers before, murdering strangers for the sake of murdering them. And this, after Charlie, you could see Whitman up in the tower at Austin, Texas, up in the University Tower, shooting 21 people he didn't know. Speck killed 8 nurses that he didn't know. A lot of the modern mass murders involved, you know, churches or schools or supermarkets, and the person doesn't know who he's killing. It's not the point anymore. It's not the point of vengeance. It's not the point of getting even. Half the time, they're not even mad, you know? Charlie wasn't mad at these people. He did it for the sake of doing it. And it was a brand new phenomena in American history. And that's why I used that subtitle, It Changed America. It got picked up by television. Television was now omnipresent in the country. 85% of the households had it. And because he was on the run for so long, it ran nightly. A national news, Huntley Brinkley, picked it up. They could deal with their affiliate in Lincoln and carry that live around the country, which had just happened. You never do that before. So television hits violence, connects with violence. And it was an unholy alliance, but it absolutely captivated people because now you had Charlie. He was in your house. He was in your living room. He was in your dining room, you know. And before it was just a piece of paper or something on the radio. Now it was, you could sit and actually kind of relive the murders themselves.
So Charlie's next stop was at the home at Lauer Ward, where, once again, it was a multiple murder at that location.
It was the maid and the housewife, Mrs. Ward and the maid. Lauer Ward was off at work. His son, who I knew, was away at prep school. And both the maid and Mrs. Ward were stabbed to death many, many, many times. I think Mrs. Ward ended up with like 16 stab wounds on both the front and then turned over on the back. And the maid, like 7 or 8 stab wounds in her chest and in her lungs and her heart and so forth to kill her. So they were very violent murders. And then when Mr. Ward came home, and he was shot to death with the 22.
So, Harry, after 10 murders over several days at several different locations with travel time, et cetera, I think it's the time I have to ask the question, why didn't Carol Ann Fugate run?
Yeah, that was the basis for most people convicting her in their mind, was that she could have run. And there was a defense at that time called duress. If you acted under duress, contrary to your natural instincts because of the force of another person, that was a defense. But they didn't know how to develop that because there was no psychology, there was no trauma psychology, there was no PTSD, there was no multiple personalities. It was just kind of leftover Freudian stuff going on. So they didn't look at once again, assuming that she was not there when her parents were murdered, the impact on her of watching Charlie shoot one of his friends, blow his head off, for a 14-year-old girl, that the brain science now tells us that the brain is going to shut down on that. The activity, the prefrontal cortex is going to be overridden with the signs that it's going to be fight, flight, or freeze. In that sort of situation, flight wouldn't have got, she couldn't have run away from Charlie there. She was out in the middle of nowhere and he had a gun. And she can't fight him. He's bigger, stronger. She froze, basically. That's my theory. And when she describes that later on in her life, well, actually in court, she says, after the killing, I saw myself standing over there screaming, but I couldn't hear myself. I froze. Today, that is dissociation language. If you look at trauma psychology, that's the classic language that people use who have been so traumatized that they dissociate from the, I froze, I froze, I froze. And I think that's what happened. And there were chances where she could have gotten away if her brain, her 14-year-old brain now, which is not fully developed by any stretch of the imagination, was able to make those choices and see the consequences and grab the opportunity. Most brain science today would tell you she probably couldn't have made, just like with rape victims, they used to question them. Why didn't you fight back? Why didn't you run? And it was real damaging testimony. And then all the science came out, they couldn't run. They didn't have the cognitive ability to make the decisions to flee. And I think she ended up in the same place.
After the Ward massacre, there was one more murder before Charlie and Carol Ann Fugate were captured.
They had found he was driving the Ward car, which was a fancy Packard, and he heard over the radio that they had identified the car. And so he pulled over. There was this poor guy sitting in his traveling salesman sitting in his car taking a nap. Charlie kills him. He later claimed that Carol was the one who put 8 bullets in him. I don't think Carol knew how to operate a 22 to hit somebody in the head with 8 bullets. You know, Charlie did. He was a dead shot. No question about that. But anyway, right after that happened, the deputy just pulls up by chance. Carol runs off to the car and claims, you know, Starkweather wants to kill her. Starkweather zooms off in the he's back in the Packard by this point. And the police chief from Douglas, Wyoming, and the county sheriff from Douglas, Wyoming, take off after him. And it's this wild chase through the Badlands. They go back through Douglas. Charlie leads them back through Douglas. They hook their bumper onto his at one point. He hits the accelerator and jumps away from him. The police chief has got his pistol out, and he's firing at Charlie. He's actually trying to hit him, I think. They get out of Douglas. Charlie gets up to 110 miles an hour over these hills and valleys, and the cops are chasing him. Now the police chief has got his 30-30 out, and he's trying to get him with the rifle. Might be easier to do. So he does, and he Charlie's run out of ammo by this point. His dream was to have a shootout with the cops, but he's out of ammunition. He says this, and I think it's true. I don't think they ever found any ammunition in the car. And so he stops, and they capture him. He confesses within 2 or 3 hours of being captured. He confesses to all 11 crimes, and they hadn't even charged him with the gas station attendant. They didn't know he was involved in that. So he writes letters, and he gives oral statements saying, basically, I did everything, Carol did nothing. And they managed to get him back to Nebraska from Douglas, Wyoming, in about a day and a half. It was amazing that they could do it. They wanted him so bad back there. And they kind of had to rough up the local yokels in Douglas to do it. They said, you know, there might be people still alive in Lincoln. We need to get him questioned and get him back there. And so anyway, they ended up, and the governor backed off, and they got him back to Lincoln on, this would have been Friday night. So it started Tuesday morning, and they're back in Nebraska Friday night, having killed 10 more people.
So at this point, the killing spree is over, thank God. But you do point out in your book, Harry, that had the cops been a little bit more attentive at Carol Ann Fugate's parents' house, they may have discovered the bodies of her family, and they may have indeed been able to stop Charlie before, you know, the next murder, before any of this went further. The bodies, clearly, they weren't in the house, but they were in an outbuilding, you know, on the property.
Hey, Charlie had moved him into a chicken coop and into an outdoor toilet. And they were stuck out there, and you've got, you know, you're in the middle of Nebraska winter. Everything like that is going to be frozen. But one of the issues was the cops did go, they came to the house when the grandmother brought them, and they looked around and said, nothing. We don't see anything. Two detectives. And there was plenty of evidence in the house had they looked carefully. Charlie didn't get all the blood off. There was a sawed-off shotgun barrel. There was a car in the driveway. All they had to do was to walk to this outbuilding, which was 5 yards away from the back door, open the door, and they would have seen it. And if they had done that, that would have happened about 11 o'clock in the morning. Charlie didn't start killing people till 4. They might well have caught him.
So, Harry, as we talked earlier, you had pointed out that after Charlie was originally captured, in his, you know, first statements to the police, he pretty much exonerated Carol Ann, said she really was not a participant. And then later on, he implicates her in some of the murders. What do you think made him change his mind?
Yeah, I mean, it's my theory that his fantasy always was to go out in a blaze of glory, in a shootout. And what he needed to make that fantasy work was a girlfriend. He got a girlfriend. He got Carol at age 13. So the fantasy's there, but he wanted to die. He would have been happy dying in front of her with a shootout, so she would believe that he would kill for her. But it dawned on him that she might well not be convicted. And his fantasy was that she go out with him. And once she started to see that they didn't, they just charged her with this felony murder, not actually murdering anybody, you started to see that she probably would not be electrocuted. And this is my theory, and started changing his story, giving evidence to the prosecutor to implicate her in at least two murders, the one of Carol King and the maid. Just well, and the traveling salesman too. So three, he nailed her for three. I think in his determination that for the story to be complete, both of them needed to be executed.
And Charlie had an opinion on how that should happen.
And that's what I got to tell you. It's, one of those things picks up a story and makes it immortal, or makes it last forever. It's a part of the culture. And that statement, everything that's ever written about him, every movie that's ever made, Bruce Springsteen's song repeats it in there. The Badlands movie repeats it. And what he says, and there's some question as to whether he said it or his lawyer said it. I looked into that because it's always argued, and came up with the conclusion that he said it to his father. And basically what he said was, "I don't mind dying in the chair as long as she's sitting on my lap." And Springsteen took that, and in his song Nebraska, which is a it's in the Nebraska album, but it's a very, very powerful, haunting song. Changes that a little bit. It's not quite cool enough. And so he says, he has Charlie saying, "I don't mind dying if my pretty baby is sitting on my lap." He has to give Carol a little spin there, to put a little sexy thing in it. But yeah, I mean, that line is what really stands for that whole story. And I think I'm convinced Charlie said it.
Now, again, his lawyer wanted to go for an insanity defense, and he would want no part of it because that's not part of the legend to be crazy. So he didn't want that. But I think it's sort of the I love how lawyers sometimes, well, you're a lawyer, I'm sorry, I don't mean to insult you, but slip things, a defense lawyer who's doing the best for their client, of course, saying he's going to the chair if I don't find a way out of this. There's no way he can prove he didn't do it. He's saying he did it. So the only way we're gonna and he, the insanity. But just to move, because I really do want to move to Carol, who is the more interesting intricacy of the trial. I don't think it was a doubt from the beginning that he was going to be convicted, and he was convicted and was sentenced to death. And she went second, and I think there was question whether he was going to testify. And I guess at first he wasn't, but he actually did testify at her trial, didn't he?
Yes, he came in and testified, and for some reason they let in evidence as to all the other murders. She was just charged with the felony murder of Bobby Jensen, remember that? But for some reason the judge allowed in evidence of all the murders, all 10 of them. I don't think they put the gas station guy in there, but so Charlie was allowed to allocate guilt for all of those murders, and he claimed that she had killed Carol King, the maid, and the traveling salesman. And she, in effect, she was convicted of stuff she wasn't charged for, and that it should have been reversed. A lot of things were wrong with that. Her statement that she gave was after 17 hours of interrogation. Here's a 14-year-old girl. Her parents are dead. She has no lawyer, no one standing up for her, no advocate. And the cops come in, and the interrogator, and there's police in the room and a stenographer and everything. And she gives this statement where she basically says stuff like, "Yeah, I could have run. And I watched out for when, the police were coming and woke Charlie up." And that statement is what they convicted her on. And today that would never be allowed in under Miranda, but it shouldn't have been allowed in back then. The law back then was that a statement, a confession, had to be voluntary. How you could call that voluntary, knowing it can't be voluntary unless it's knowing. And how they, she didn't know the difference between a prosecutor and a defense lawyer. You can look at her testimony. She got confused as to who did what. And to say she understood the consequences of the statement she was making is just crazy. But without that, the only evidence you had against her was Charlie's statement. And you couldn't convict as a matter of law on what he said, because he had like 11 different stories of what she did and didn't do. So,
but she was convicted, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was convicted of felony murder and sentenced to prison for 17, well, for life. And then through a series of hearings and so forth, they reduced it and she got out in 17 years.
But that's not the end of the story, and certainly not the end of your book.
She was, they got a progressive warden after she'd been there about 5 years, and she worked closely with Carol. And Carol was eventually allowed to go into town to the church services. She sat for Sunday school, took care of the kids. She worked in a nursing home. She even kind of traveled the state and gave lectures to high school students about stuff. And
she participated in the first movie about her case.
Malik, I can't think of his first name. This was the filmmaker. This was his first movie. Terry made it. Terry Malik. And he was taken by the story and connected with Carol's lawyer, and whose father had represented Carol throughout the trial. And they set up a meeting in the prison with Carol, and Carol, you know, went along with it, went along with the movie. And she was still in prison, although it was like 70, I think that movie came out in 72, and she had had perfect behavior by that point, so wasn't much of a risk. But they actually bring Martin Sheen, who plays Charlie. Sissy Spacek, who played Carol, did not come to the signing, but Malik was there, Malik and his wife. So they had a showing. The first showing was in York. I think it was like the Last Chance restaurant. It had a phrase much like that. And they sat there, and that was the first time the world had seen the clip. And Carol's sitting there next to Martin Sheen, watching him. And very strange.
You can't make this stuff up.
No, and that's why I put a picture of them in the
it's
book.
It's a great picture. It's in the book, folks. It's a picture of them all lined up, and she's smiling like it's a, you know, opening of a supermarket.
Yeah, she's standing right next to Martin Sheen.
Now, Harry, I can't let you go until you recount for my audience the story in the epilogue to your book, Starkweather, The Untold Story of the Killing Spree That Changed America.
I had a problem as a writer as to whether to weave in my researching the story and encountering my past and my childhood and my, you know, delinquent behavior into the story, or to make it separate. And I decided early on to make it separate. You can tell from reading it that I'm not an outsider. I don't say it, but you can see that somebody knows what's going on here a little bit more than somebody who parachuted in from New Jersey. So in the end, then when it's all over, and Carol's, you know, released from prison and so forth, she does get married, and they have a bad car accident. Her husband dies in it, and she's severely injured in it. But at the end of it, I hadn't found her, and she was basically being hidden. That's my view. And her friends didn't know where she was. Her lawyers didn't know where she was. And through a stroke of good fortune, which I can't really reveal, I was given the place as to where she was. It's a nursing home. And I flew out there and went, kind of talked my way into the nursing home, sat and talked to her for about an hour, talked with her, let's say, communicated with her. She has trouble talking. She's from a stroke that she had. But she knew who I was, and she knew what I was doing. And I brought some pictures of her family that I'd gotten from her lawyer and gave those to her. And we were about an hour into it, and the two kind of nurse ratchets walk in the room and say, who are you? And I said, well, I'm a friend of her lawyer. I just happened to be in town, which wasn't the truth. But they said, okay. So they came back, and I thought, well, I've got about 5 minutes. And sure enough, in 5 minutes, they came back and said, What's your name? I said, Harry McLean. They said, well, the Guardian doesn't want you in here. You're going to have to leave.
And you got
Carol.
the bum's rush.
Yeah. And Carol was furious at him. She was mad at him. She was waving and trying to wave him off and get him out of the room because this was somebody that was listening to her story, you know, probably for the first time in her life, really.
So, Harry, now that you've had a little bit of time since working and putting the book together, what are your thoughts about the case?
It's it probably comes back to the suffering that was imposed on these people and the innocence and the loss of innocence that Nebraska had and that the country had. Because by you know before then, if you played by the rules, if you lived straight, if you went to college, if you went to church, you know, if you paid your bills, in Lincoln, Nebraska, life made sense. It no longer made sense, not only for Lincoln, but for the country itself. This stuff could strike from nowhere for no reason. And I've often said that Lincoln ended up kind of suffering from cultural PTSD. They still relive the trauma. When I go there, talk and speak and so forth, people come forward and say, yeah, I was a girl. Fourth grade when this happened, and I remember my dad coming to school with a shotgun, and the school closed down. All the parents were showing up armed because of the fear. And when they're telling me the story, often you can kind of see it reverberate in them because they were children, and they were seeing their father scared for the first time in their life. So that kind of the it's the twist, it's the historical twist in the country. It's never been the same from that point on. And that's kind of a sociological point of view. Personally, like I say, I knew the boy whose father was murdered, and I saw the suffering that he went through and other victims did. And you end up kind of, we don't have any explanation for Charlie, just like we don't have any explanation for the mass murderers today.
So tell me, Harry, do you have like a website or a Facebook page where people can learn more about you?
Website is probably the best. It's and that's just Harry McLean. Just have to remember it's MACLEAN. HarryMclean.com. It's got the whole works.
Great, great. And so I want to thank you again for joining us today on Murder Most Foul. I know you're in another state. I won't divulge where you are, but you're soon flying home. So please have a safe trip.
Thanks for having me. Let's do it again soon.
Before I sign off, I would like to just one more time mention Harry's books, Starkweather, which we were talking about today. Also, In Broad Daylight, which is another true crime book with a bit of a twist. And The Past Is Never Dead, The Trial of James Ford Seal and Mississippi's Struggle for Redemption. I hope you'll pick one or all of them up. And so, in final closing, I do hope that you enjoyed today's podcast. And if you did, you'll tell your friends. The podcast has a website whereby you can link to all the other episodes. And also, there's an email link there, which will allow you to get a message to me. And the address for the podcast is www.murdermostfoul, all one word, no caps, no spaces, .com. So, until we meet again, stay safe. And for God's sakes, don't murder anyone.